vaccines given separately. Furthermore, the pentavalent vaccine is life-threatening to infants. Before its Indian debut, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Vietnam previewed the pentavalent jab. In each of these countries, unexplained deaths followed immunization. Bhutan suspended the immunization program in October 2009 after 5 cases of encephalopathy encephalitis occurred following the vaccine. WHO persuaded health officials to resume the program, insisting that viral meningoencephalitis caused the deaths. Bhutan obeyed, and 4 infants died. Bhutan no longer uses the pentavalent vaccine. The Director of Public Health, Dr. Ugyen Dofu, observes that there have been no more cases of meningoencephalitis among infants after the vaccine was withdrawn. Sri Lanka unleashed the pentavalent vaccine in January 2008 and then suspended the program 4 months later after 5 babies died. Under pressure from WHO, Sri Lanka reintroduced the vaccine in 2010. Between 2010 and 2012, there were 14 additional deaths following the vaccine, making the total number of deaths in Sri Lanka 19. Vietnam introduced the pentavalent jab in June 2010 and suspended the jab in May 2013 after 27 infant deaths. The experience in Pakistan was similar, including at least 3 reported deaths. India introduced pentavalent vaccine in December 2011. Up to the first quarter of 2013, health officials reported 83 serious adverse events following immunization, AEFI. 21 babies have died in India following immunization with the pentavalent vaccine. Gates and WHO simply trivialized the deaths as sad coincidences or collateral damage. The vaccine has effectively reduced the incidence of Hib disease in India. However, there has been a proportionate increase in non-Hib strains of H. influenzae, including non-serotypable strains, causing invasive disease in the post-Hib vaccine era. As usual, there was no accounting. This is only one of many examples of the Gates Foundation prioritizing the mandate for high-cost vaccines in the national immunization programs that Bill Gates effectively controls. Putting aside questions about net costs and benefits from these dangerous jabs, McGoey agrees with Pouliel that the diversion of sanitation and nutrition money is also deadly. The problem is that by prioritizing the delivery of expensive vaccines, other proven interventions lose out. Real-world evidence, including his investments in pharmaceutical, petroleum, chemical, and GMO processed and synthetic food, suggests that Gates' obsession with vaccines does not evince any genuine commitment to healthy populations. According to Amy Goodman, Gates owns investments in 69 of the world's worst polluting companies. His single-minded obsession with vaccines seems to serve his impulse to monetize his charity and to achieve monopoly control over global public health policy. His strategies and corporate alliances in the food, public health, and education sectors may also reflect messianic conviction that he is ordained to save the world with technology, top-down centralized cookie-cutter solutions to complex human problems, and a godlike willingness to experiment with the lives of lesser humans. And Gates's vaccine cartel has amassed Midas-like riches. Early in 2021, a TV interviewer, Becky Quick, observed that Gates had spent $10 billion on vaccines over the past 2 decades and asked Gates, "You've figured out the return on investment for that, and it kind of stunned me. Can you walk us through the math?" Gates responded, "We see a phenomenal track record. there's been over a 20-to-1 return. So if you just looked at the economic benefits, that's a pretty strong number. The interviewer pressed him. If you had put that money into an S&P 500 and reinvested the dividends, you'd come up with something like $17 billion. But you think it's $200 billion. Gates continued, "Here, yeah," hastening to add that helping young children live, get the right nutrition, contribute to their countries, that has a payback that goes beyond any typical financial return. The key to it all, he added, is having that big portfolio. And the key to much of that portfolio is having Anthony Fauci. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments and notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook. Chapter 11, Hyping Phony Epidemics, Crying Wolf. Governments do like epidemics, just the same way as they like war, really. It's a chance to impose their will on us and get us all scared so that we huddle together and do what we're told. Dr. Damien Downing, President, British Society of Ecological Medicine, Al Jazeera, 2009. Fear is a market. To instill fear in people also has advantages, not only in terms of drug use. Anxiety-driven people are easier to rule. Gerd Gigerenzer, Director Emeritus at the Max Planck Institute for Educational Research, Torsten Engelbrecht, Virus Mania 2021. In 1906, infectious disease caused a third of all annual deaths in the United States, and 800 to 1,000 of every 100,000 Americans died of infectious disease. By 1976, fewer than 50 Americans per 100,000 died of infectious diseases, and CDC and NIAID were under extreme pressure to justify their budgets. Hyping pandemics became an institutional strategy in both agencies. Pharmaceutical companies and international health agencies, banking and military contractors soon found purchase in the ecosystem, and random pandemics discovered their own self-perpetuating rationale. Dr. Fauci's critics chide him for routinely exaggerating and even concocting global disease outbreaks to hype pandemic panic, elevate the biosecurity agenda, boost agency funding, promote profitable vaccines for his pharma partners, and magnify his own power. The historical record supports these charges. 1976 Swine Flu. As chief of the NIAID's clinical physiology section of the Laboratory of Clinical Investigation, Dr. Fauci was, in 1976, a frontline spectator during the NIH's bogus swine flu pandemic. That year, a soldier at Fort Dix died of a lung ailment following a forced march. Army physicians sent some samples to CDC, which identified the malady as a swine flu. Dr. Fauci's NIAID boss, Richard Krauss, who Dr. Fauci would shortly replace, labored with his CDC counterpart, David Sensor, to spread terror of a catastrophic pandemic and initiate public demand for a vaccine. The NIAID chief convened in-house strategy sessions with Merck's iconic vaccine developer, Maurice Hilleman, and other immunization industry nabobs. Congressional investigators subsequently landed the notes from those consultations, in which Dr. Hilleman candidly confesses that the resulting vaccine had nothing to do with science and everything to do with politics. In the August 2020 Rolling Stone, Gerald Posner, author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America, recounted how Merck and other manufacturers utilized their secret meeting with the regulators to hatch a scheme that would guarantee industry profits while shielding pharma from liability. This innovation, now a persistent feature of Big Pharma's business model, turned out to be carte blanche for negligent and even criminal behavior. Pharma and NIAID told Congress, the White House, and the public that the Fort Dix swine flu was the same strain responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, which they warned had killed 50 million people worldwide. They were lying. Scientists at Fort Dix, the CDC, and HHS knew that H1N1 was an ordinary pig virus posing no risk for humans. Nevertheless, NIAID conducted a hard sell campaign warning of 1 million deaths in the United States. Working with the pharmaceutical companies, NIAID, CDC, and Merck persuaded incoming President Gerald Ford to sign a bill appropriating $135 million for vaccine manufacturers to inoculate 140 million Americans against the pestilence. At the behest of federal regulators, Ford appeared on TV urging all Americans to get vaccinated. Ford's obligatory references to the 1918 Spanish flu mass fatalities inspired some 50 million U.S. citizens to hot-foot it to their local health center for injections of hastily concocted, shoddily tested, zero-liability vaccines that HHS and Merck conspired to rush to market. CDC Director David Sensor set up a swine flu war room to bolster public fear amongst an enthused media. The government launched a full-scale promotional campaign, including terrifying TV commercials depicting remorseful patients who dodged their vaccination and suffered serious illness. A CDC press release claimed that popular TV star Mary Tyler Moore had taken the jab. Moore told 60 Minutes she had avoided the shot due to her concerns about side effects. She said that she and her doctor were very happy she didn't get it. In the end, the actual number of pandemic swine flu casualties in 1976 was not 1 million, but one. Dr. Harvey Fineberg, who authored the government's 1978 comprehensive postmortem of NIAID's response to that fake pandemic, told the WHO bulletin, "In 76, the virus was detected in a single military installation at Fort Dix, New Jersey. In the ensuing weeks and months, not one related swine flu case was reported elsewhere in New Jersey, the USA, or anywhere else in the world." At the same time, political decision makers consistently thought that the scientists were giving them no choice but to go ahead with a mass immunization program. NIH's influenza and flu vaccine expert, senior bacteriologist and virologist, Dr. John Anthony Morris, informed his HHS bosses that the flu scare was a farce and that NIAID's campaign was a boondoggle to promote a dangerous and ineffective flu vaccine for a greedy industry. Dr. Morris had worked for 36 years at federal public health agencies beginning in 1940. His office, at the time of the 1976 outbreak, was a few doors down the hall from Tony Fauci's. Morris served as the government's chief vaccine officer and led research on the flu and flu vaccines for the Bureau of Biologics Standards, BBS, at NIH and later at FDA. Morris enjoyed a distinguished career researching viral respiratory diseases. When Dr. Morris protested the fraud, his direct superior ordered him to stand down, advising Morris not to talk about this. His NIH bosses threatened Dr. Morris with loss of employment and professional ruin if he failed to keep his mouth shut. When vaccine recipients began reporting adverse reactions, including Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS, Dr. Morris disobeyed orders. publicly declaring that there was zero evidence that the Fort Dix swine flu was contagious to humans, he reiterated the vaccine could induce neurological side effects. In response, HHS officials confiscated Dr. Morris's research materials, changed the laboratory locks, moved him to a small room with no telephone, reassigned his laboratory staff, forbade him to see visitors except with permission, and blocked his efforts to publish his findings. Finally, after months of threats and petty harassment, HHS fired Morris for insubordination, citing a long list of drummed-up charges, including failure to return library books on time. Over at CDC, scientist Dr. Michael Hatwick was also warning HHS bigwigs that the flu vaccine could cause widespread brain injuries. The 1976 swine flu vaccine was so fraught with problems that HHS discontinued the jab after vaccinating 49 million Americans. According to news accounts, the incidence of flu was 7 times greater among the vaccinated than the unvaccinated. Furthermore, the vaccine caused some 500 cases of the degenerative nerve disease Guillain-Barré syndrome, 32 deaths, more than 400 paralyzations, and as many as 4,000 other injuries. Public health officials pulled the vaccine. President Ford fired David Sensor. American taxpayers ended up paying for the swine flu vaccine coming and going, through guaranteed profits for Merck at the front end and outlays for piles of lawsuits from vaccine injury victims on the other side. The government paid $134 million for the swine flu vaccine program. Injured plaintiffs filed 1,604 lawsuits. By April 1985, the government had paid out $83,233,714 and spent tens of millions of dollars adjudicating and processing those claims. In 1987, Dr. Morris testified before Congress, these figures give some idea of the consequences resulting from a program in which the federal government assumes liability of a product known to produce, in an indeterminate number of recipients, serious damage to health. When I left the FDA in 1976, there was no available technique to measure, reliably and consistently, neurotoxicity or potency of most of vaccines then in use, including DTP vaccines. Today, 1987, 11 years later, the situation remains essentially the same. Dr. Morris's research found that flu vaccines often induced fever in children and in pregnant women, and serious harm to the fetus. He worried that there were hidden risks for everyone because the vaccine was literally loaded with extraneous bacteria. According to Dr. Morris, there is a great deal of evidence to prove that immunization of children does more harm than good. In what serves as a concise epithet for his crosses, Dr. Morris stated, there is a close tie between government scientists and manufacturing scientists. My results were hurting the market for flu vaccines. In 1977, Dr. Morris instituted a wrongful dismissal suit. The court overturned all NIH's charges against him. Subsequently, a grievance committee unanimously found that his supervisors had harassed and wrongfully terminated Dr. Morris. A group of former FDA and NIH scientists endorsed Dr. Morris's criticisms of the agency. The New York Times quoted a fellow scientist, B.G. Young, who characterized NIH's reprisals against honest scientists as suppression, harassment, and censorship of individual investigators. I finally came to realize that you either had to compromise yourself or leave. Morris and Bernice Eddy are the real heroes in that place because they stayed and fought. The others voted with their feet and left. Up until his death in July 2014, Dr. Morris remained an outspoken critic of CDC's annual flu shot program. In 1979, Dr. Morris told the Washington Post, "It's a medical ripoff. I believe the public should have truthful information on the basis of which they can determine whether or not to take the vaccine. I believe that given full information, they won't take the vaccine." Dr. Morris's 2014 New York Times obituary reported his statement, "The producers of these influenza vaccines know they are worthless, but they go on selling them anyway." Dr. B.G. Young told the New York Times that NIH's industry-dominated culture at the vaccine division had driven away all the honest regulators, those willing to stand up to pharma. Dr. Fauci, in contrast, is the rare scientist who lasted 50 years at HHS. He has done so largely by